You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this guy here, our beloved football player, Tom Brady. He's 44 this year. He's accomplished a lot in the game of football. People view him as the GOAT, the greatest of all time. He's the three-time NFL MVP, and he's in line. He's the front runner for this year as well at this point in the season. I think he'll get it. Seven-time Super Bowl champion. He holds a lot of NFL records, 30 related to the regular season, 29 playoff records, 26 Super Bowl records, 15 career records, for a grand total of 100 NFL records by a single man, and I'm sure he'll get more before he retires. It's interesting when you look at Brady. He did an interview about 15 years ago on 60 Minutes. And at the time, he'd only been in the league a couple of years and he'd won 3 Super Bowls. And the interviewer, Steve Croft, says this. He says, "Which of the rings do you like the best? What's your favorite ring out of the 3 Super Bowl rings?" And he goes, "My favorite ring? I've always said that's the next one. The next one is the best." 3 rings and his favorite one is the one he hasn't gotten yet. Isn't that interesting? He goes on, and Croft is commenting on just, this guy came on the scene, he won all these Super Bowls, and this is 4 victories ago, 4 Super Bowl victories ago. He says, "This whole experience, this whole upward trajectory, what have you learned about yourself?" And Brady says, "Well, I put incredible amounts of pressure on me. A lot of times I think I get very frustrated and introverted, and there's times where I'm not the person I want to be. Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me?" I mean, a lot of people would say, "Hey, man, this is what is. I've reached my goal, my dream, my life." Me, I think, "God, it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. All these accomplishments. He was told, this is what's going to make you happy. He's the greatest of all time." And he's like, "Is that it?" And then he goes on and says, "I mean, I've done it. I'm 27. What else is there for me?" And Croft says, "What's the answer?" And he says, "I wish I knew. I wish I knew." And how many people, they've got what the world said. They've achieved in their career, in their profession, in their life, the best, all of their goals. And they're saying, "I wish I knew. I wish I knew." He does say, "I know what ultimately makes me happy are family and friends and positive relationships with great people. I think I get more out of that than anything." Isn't it interesting as well with him, and we'll see this tonight, it's the relational side of life. The simple things that any of us can do, build relationships, that actually bring the most happiness. I think that's a pretty hopeful message. Well, tonight we're going to take a look at King Solomon, and believe it or not, Solomon, in Ecclesiastes, he's writing from the end of his life. And at this point, he's a guy who's accomplished even more than Brady. Talk about the GOAT, all right? King Solomon. We've already seen some biographical stuff on him. But imagine if he sat down with an interviewer and the person asked that same question, this whole experience, this whole upward trajectory, what have you learned about yourself? What would he say? Well, he would say what we're reading here in the book of Ecclesiastes. And so let's see what Solomon has to say. I'll pick up the scene in chapter 2, which we read already. It's his long biographical section. I'll highlight a few parts, and then we'll jump to chapter 4, where he expands on this. But Solomon talks about this time in his life. Incredibly wealthy, incredibly wise. He had it all, but he wandered from God. But here's what he says. "I tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself, by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I filled them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water, to irrigate my many flourishing groves." This guy was an architect, a builder extraordinaire. He accomplished so much. His building projects are legendary. We read about these in the Old Testament. Just some examples here. He spent 7 years building the temple. This was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Absolutely unbelievable. You know, gold all across the inside. You know, here's a picture from the inside of that temple. A massive structure in a day before power tools, power equipment of any kind. He also spent 13 years building his palace, not just his palace, but an entire complex with multiple different buildings, living quarters, government building headquarters. This is one artist's rendering of that complex that Solomon built. Absolutely astounding for ancient man to build something like this. Not only that, his huge throne, you know, this is back in the days before big pickup trucks, you know, kings really wanted a big throne, right, to show how bad they were, you know. So you've just got this absolutely luxurious, ostentatious, when foreign dignitaries came in, they would see, whoa, they'd be so impressed. Not to mention all of his many other cities, some of which have been excavated today. These are real places. Hazor, Megiddo, Gezer, Beth Horon, Baalath, Tamar, the walls of Jerusalem, supply centers, chariot stables, all kinds of building projects he had going on. Well, what does he say at the end of it all? My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. So he says, on the one hand, I did receive a certain amount of satisfaction from it because we were made to work, and work does bring satisfaction. And my heart took delight in it. But, he said, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. He's used that phrase multiple times in this book, trying to grab onto the wind and it just slips right through your fingers. You know, work by itself, some satisfaction, a lot of satisfaction can be had. Trying to make it the ultimate satisfaction, the ultimate meaning, he says, that's like trying to grab the wind. And the more you try to do that, the more you will see that your work, that your accomplishments simply cannot bring ultimate meaning to your life. Nothing was gained under the sun. And remember, he's arguing here from an under the sun perspective. If this world is all that there is, and we might look to work for ultimate fulfillment. And he says, you're looking in the wrong place. Under the sun. Under the sun, work is a bad place to put your hope, your achievements. He goes on later in this same chapter and begins to talk about his deterioration the more he pursued this. He says, I began to hate all the things I had toiled for under the sun, these things that were supposed to make him happy. He looks at them and he's disgusted by them. Why? Well, one reason is because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. Why can't you find ultimate meaning in your accomplishments? Well, the first reason he gives us in 2:18 is you got to pass the baton at some point. You know, you might build it bigger and bigger and bigger. Those building projects, that organization, that company, that legacy, that resume, that Hall of Fame record. 100 records and counting. But at some point under the sun, your time is over. It's done. And the book on the resume is completed. You know, like Solomon, maybe you pass the baton to somebody else. But he says, who knows whether that person that comes after me will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. And you wonder if at this point he could already see what a fool his son Rehoboam was. If you read the historical narrative, his son Rehoboam, he lost 80% of Solomon's kingdom in the first year of his reign. Not the first year, the first week. He made it 1 week. And the northern 10 tribes rebelled because of his own folly. He could have kept them. By the end of his reign, so much of the wealth has just dissipated. The kingdom has begun to shrink down. He probably lost 90% of what Solomon did over his lifetime. A fool. So don't put your hope and your accomplishments under the sun for one reason, because you're going to have to pass the baton at some point. As we move down to chapter 4, he's going to expand on this more. He says, well, then I considered all the skillful work that is done. I looked out across a world of commerce, a world of employment, a world where people are diligently exercising their skills, applying their trade, making a profit. And what does he say? What is his observation? Here's what I noticed, he said. Surely it's nothing more than competition between one person and another. Nothing more than competition. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. And so he sees so much of what we do, what we try to accomplish. We're simply looking over at the other person, looking over at the other person, and we're competing. We're envying what they have. We're competing. We're trying to be better than the next guy. So why can't you find ultimate meaning in your accomplishments? He gives another reason here in 4:4. Because someone better always comes along. You can't stay at the top forever. There's that saying, you can be all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but not all of the people all of the time. It's pretty profound. There's always somebody better coming along. And even if maybe you're on top of the game right now, before long, somebody better is going to come along. I'll give several examples of this. You know, what happens when I'm not the best anymore, when my legacy fades? You know, what do I mean? Do I lose my identity? You know, do I really matter because I'm the best? Do I really matter because I'm accomplishing, I'm achieving, I'm getting that grade, I'm closing that deal, I'm getting that promotion? I'm the best at this, I'm the best at that. But what happens when I'm not anymore? It's a very shaky foundation upon which to build an identity, upon which to take my happiness, upon which to really matter. Did you guys see this last year? The Last Dance. So good. This came out right at the beginning of the pandemic. It's Michael Jordan reflecting back on his legacy. You know, there's a whole debate. Who's the greatest of all time in the NBA? A lot of people think it's Jordan. But they interview his coach, Phil Jackson, who's the greatest coach of all time so far in the NBA. And here's what he says, something that I think really sums up a lot of this series. Jackson says, we have this statement. You're only a success at the moment you perform a successful act. And then you have to do it again. You're only a success at the moment you perform a successful act, and then you have to do it again. And that's fine, I guess, as long as you can do it again. But the next time you do it, it doesn't seem to quite have the same oomph to it. And there's going to come a time when you can't do it again anymore. And if this is my basis for why I matter, basis for my identity, it might get results in the short term, but long term, this is not a basis for finding meaning, a basis for finding worth. Jordan is lamenting in one of the last episodes here. He says, you know, it's maddening. He talks about their six NBA titles. He was 6-for-6 on trips to the finals on winning. He says, it's maddening because I think we could have won 7. I really believe that. We may not have, but man, to not be able to try, that's something that I just can't accept. For whatever reason, I just can't accept it. Do you hear the echoes of Solomon here? This is meaningless. This is chasing the wind. Everybody's motivated by competition with another. We're looking over and defining myself by how do I compare to them? Trying to cement that legacy. And you know, one of the things that really stands out in this 10-part documentary is just how much he had to keep striving and striving for some reason to compete, some reason to give his all, some competitive edge. He talks about this in his Hall of Fame speech in 2009. For this Hall of Fame speech, one of the things about Michael Jordan is that he was cut. He didn't make the varsity team when he was in 10th grade in high school. He was cut. And the guy that made the team was this guy, Leroy Smith, in his place. I'm not kidding. Leroy Smith has become kind of famous for this reason. Michael Jordan flew Leroy Smith out to his Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And when he got to this point in the speech, he said, Leroy Smith. And I was like, ah. When he made the team and I didn't, I wanted to prove not just to Leroy Smith, not just to myself, but to the coach that picked Leroy over me. I wanted to make sure you understood. You made a mistake, dude. Here he is, the greatest of all time, perhaps. He's flying Leroy out to the Hall of Fame ceremony and calling out his high school coach. It's that competition. The motivation. Here's another sports star, Chris Everett. She actually has the best win-loss percentage record in tennis history, men or women. Better than all the male tennis stars, better than all the great female tennis stars. It was her. And as she contemplated her retirement, here's what she said. She said, I had no idea who I was or what I could be away from tennis. I was depressed and afraid because so much of my life had been defined by my being a tennis champion. I was completely lost. Winning made me feel like I was somebody. It made me feel pretty. It was like being hooked on a drug. I needed the wins, the applause, in order to have an identity. Here she is, one of the greatest of all time. And she says, I didn't know who I was. I needed the wins, the applause to have an identity. And Solomon says, comparison between one person and another. I'm sure that he felt it as well as he drifted off in the direction that he drifted. Madonna, it's hard to think of a bigger pop star than her from the 80s and early 90s. Here she is in an interview with Vanity Fair. She said, I have an iron will, and all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. Again, couldn't have been more successful. Feelings of inadequacy. I push past one spell of it, and I discover myself as a special human being. I matter. I'm special. And then I get to another stage, and I think I'm mediocre and uninteresting. Again and again, my drive in life is from this horrible feeling of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. It's pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. And you know who Madonna is now in most people's eyes? She's a nobody. Mediocre at best. And yet here she's saying, even though I become somebody, I still have to prove that I'm somebody. This is what happens when we build an identity around our achievements. I'm constantly looking over at other people. What do people think? How do I compare to them? And it leads to an endless struggle, a struggle that will never end. As Solomon says, meaningless, like chasing the wind. Talk about a struggle will never end. You might as well be trying to capture the wind. John Keats, famous English poet, very famous, one of the greats. What he wrote on his epitaph, the guy only didn't even live to age 30. What he wrote on his epitaph, here lies one whose name was written in water. That's how he viewed all of his accomplishments that he made over his short life with the huge upward mobility. It's like, my name's been written in the water. And you know what happens if you write something in the water just rushes right in back over it again. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. He got it. He saw it as he reached the end of his life. One final one, Leo Tolstoy. You know, who's a greater author than him? One of the greats of literature. When he hit age 50, he reached this existential crisis. So successful, and yet he's like, what does it all mean? All of my accomplishments. Has it really gotten me anywhere? And he wrote a book called Confession. And he writes, why should I live? Why wish for anything? Why do anything? Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? He saw his accomplishments would fade away. How can we fail to see this? As soon as one is sober, it's impossible not to see. It's all a mere fraud and a stupid fraud. He's like, I was tricked. I was deceived. It's mere fraud. They're lying to us. These are with the greatest of all time. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. And you look at these testimonies from the goats, the greatest of all time. Tolstoy, it's all a mere fraud. Keats, my name was carved in the water. Madonna, even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that I am somebody. Chris Everett, I needed the wins, the applause in order to have an identity. Jordan, Phil Jackson, you're only a success at the moment you perform a successful act, and then you have to do it again. Brady, I wish I knew, man, I wish I knew. And of course, Solomon, another goat, says this too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. He saw it. He observed it. He lived it. He noticed it. Motivated by competition and by envy. And then he says a little proverb. He says, you know, I guess there's the opposite extreme from the workaholic. He says, fools fold their hands, leading them to ruin. Why can't you find ultimate meaning in your accomplishments? Well, because for some, it will just cause them to quit when they're not the best. You know, I mean, working too hard is bad. Being a lazy fool is even worse, I think, is the conclusion here. But some people, they just see, I can't compete with that. They see themselves failing to define themselves by their achievements, and so they retreat to this position of safety. I mean, I remember feeling this way. You know, this is why I didn't try out for the soccer team my senior year in high school, because I was like, I'm not going to be the first senior who doesn't make varsity, who's playing JV. I'm not going to just sit there on the bench. And I found myself failing at a lot of things and quitting a lot of things, because it's like, you know, you grow up, you're given a trophy for everything, a participation trophy, but then you start reaching the real world and you're like, I'm not the best. Where's my trophy? And so it causes this backlash the other way to this position of safety, where it's like, if I don't even try, then I can't fail. And so it leads to an inability to work, an inability to try. And that's, I think, part of what he's seeing here. It's like a complete, you know, correction, overcorrection to the opposite end of the extreme here, opposite end of the spectrum. You know, we're designed to enjoy work. That's how God created us. God is a God who works. He wants us to enjoy work. But the lazy fool, this leading them to ruin, literally says, consumes his own flesh. And so, you know, he won't have anything to eat, so he's going to sort of eat away at whatever reserves he might have, because he needs calories to live. But it has other negative effects on you. You know, laziness doesn't make you happy. We think of the life of nothingness. You know, if you're working real hard and you take a break, take a vacation, if you rest, that brings happiness. That brings a certain amount of satisfaction. But when the vacation just lasts forever, and if I could just get even more of this and do nothing, I would be happy, that's misguided folly. It's wrong thinking. You know, your life starts falling apart. He comments just a few chapters later in chapter 10. He says, fools are so exhausted by a little work, they can't even find their way home. You know, the fool's like, oh my God, I had like 3 classes today. I worked like an 8-hour shift. And you're like, really? Wow. That's rough. No one does that. Laziness leads to a sagging roof. Idleness leads to a leaky house. Your life starts falling apart. Your stuff starts falling apart. You don't do the maintenance required, and then the stuff falls apart even more. The lazy fool just lacks confidence that they can do anything. You know, they lose respect for themselves. They lose their capacity to care for others because they're so driven by their own need for rest, their own avoidance of anything hard. It's like they just haven't conditioned themselves to work. They're running from work thinking it's going to make them happy. And maybe because of some bad experiences, maybe trying to define themselves by their work. They've got a wrong view of work. They need to see work is not who I am, but it is something that's part, you know, working is part of what's going to bring satisfaction in my life. I just can't make it the ultimate thing. I can't define myself by it. And then he says, and yet, better to have one handful with quietness than 2 handfuls with hard work and chasing the wind. Yeah. So a strong work ethic is great. Workaholism is bad. You can see both extremes here. You know, you've got the one guy that's just like, I'm not going to do anything. And then you've got the other guy that's like, both hands full of work and just giving it all. And so I was like, why can't we just be in the middle where it's like, one hand full of quietness, happiness, one hand full of work. Why can't work just be work? Why do we have to make it into something that defines who I am, that self-actualizes me? We want to be hard workers, but we don't want to be workaholics. We don't want to be people that define ourselves by our work. You know, God built the Sabbath in the Old Testament into the daily life, the weekly life, the yearly life of his people. Each day they were supposed to take a whole day off. That was a big act of faith for them back then, to not work because you were barely surviving. And to say, I'm not going to work for a whole day. I'm going to rest. Look, the Sabbath, when they would observe the Sabbath, they were saying, look, work is something I do, but it's not who I am. It's something I do, but it's not who I am. Can you say that? Sabbath says, I need to provide for my needs, but God's my ultimate provider. Yeah, the purpose of work, providing for my needs, I need to, you know, something I can share with other people. I want to be a giver. But ultimately, God is my provider. Do you have the ability to just say, you know what? I have enough. I don't need more. 2 handfuls. It's like, no. 1 handful with quietness. Then 2 handfuls and chasing the wind. And then he gives an observation. He says, and I observed yet another example of something meaningless under the sun. Again, related to work. He says, this is the case of a man who is all alone, without a child or brother, yet who works hard to gain as much wealth as he can. But then he asks himself, who am I working for? Why am I giving up so much pleasure now? It's all so meaningless and depressing. Why can't you find your ultimate meaning in your accomplishments? He gives a fourth and final reason here. It's because it often leaves you all alone. This guy is all alone. You know, it's Christmas time. I can't help but think of Ebenezer Scrooge. All alone, hard-hearted, counting his money, angry that Bob Cratchit wants a day off. Bah, humbug. All alone. You know, to all appearances, this person is a winner. The world says, you're a winner. You made all the money. You're at the top of your career. You got everything you need. Except relationships. Except happiness. Because in reality, he's a loser. He's a loser. Because he's all alone. That's not what we were designed for. And his loneliness, it's no accident. You know, his life probably revolves around his work. You know, he might make some time for people if it doesn't interfere with his work. He might tell himself, oh, I'm just working to provide for my family if he has one, although he probably doesn't. But that's what a lot of people tell themselves. I'm providing a good life for my family. How many of you had parents doing that? Out working, when you're like, I would take less stuff if I just had a relationship with you, Dad, Mom. Wouldn't that be cool? No, he's really married to his job. He's addicted to work. It's defining who he is. He might be alone because of all the people he's trampled to get to the top, because of the relationships he's had to sacrifice to get to the top, because he always has to be on guard because he's at the top. He's also always looking around, worried about being overtaken. Not to mention probably worried about all his stuff and all of his investments. We'll talk about stuff next week, though. And, you know, I wonder here how much Solomon is describing his own life. Do you think he could be? I mean, he was the king. He was the top dog. But you really get the sense that he was lonely. I mean, think about his father, David. He had a lot of close friends. David went off track many times. You know, there were times early in his life he wasn't off track, but he was so discouraged. And who was there? Jonathan, one of the great friendships in Scripture, encouraging David. You can read about that in 1 Samuel. The times he went astray in his life, the prophet Nathan was there confronting him, pointing him back to the truth. The prophet Gad was there confronting him with a message from God, pointing him back to the truth. Even Joab was used by God to knock some sense into David and point him back to the truth. And David got back on track. These friends who were in his life turned him back in the right direction. Solomon, on the other hand, where were the friends in his life? Where was the Joab, the Jonathan, the Gad, the Nathan? Where were these people? He didn't have them. He didn't have them. And so even though he was very wealthy, he was actually a very poor man in that regard. He was all alone, working hard, and yet who is he working for? You got to wonder that at some point. This stuff is really not satisfying me because I have no one to share it with. And I think I've made a wrong decision. And then he says some of the most positive stuff he says in the entire book. And he says it about relationships. He says, you know, two people are better off than one. They can help each other succeed. So we see the synergy, in a close friendship, the two can work together for a common cause. He says, you know, and if one person falls down, the other one can reach out and help. But someone who falls alone is in real trouble. You know, you're there during the tough times. You're there when the other person falls down, and they're there when you fall down. We need friends in our life like this who are going to be there. Not at a distance, not even, you know, some friends wouldn't even know if you're in trouble. They wouldn't even know if you've fallen down. I mean, I've had this literally in my life. I remember 3 years ago, my dad called me up to ask me to help them move a fridge down to their basement. And this I went over there. It was supposed to be me and my dad, but my dad's got polio in one leg and one arm when he was a kid, so he basically is like kind of half disabled. And so it's just me and him. We get over there, and this is like the biggest fridge I've ever seen in my life, okay? I was like, we'll just take the door off. You can't take the door off of a fridge because it's all wired in with the water thingy and everything. So we decide, all right, we'll just do it. I'm thinking, maybe I should call my brother. Nah, we can get it. So I'm like the guy at the bottom of the stairs, kind of lowering the fridge down. I was like, I mean, after all, we had a dolly, so I mean, what could go wrong? We put the heavy thing on wheels on the stairs. So we're slowly lowering it down. I'm basically kind of shouldering this whole thing, and at a certain point, the fridge catches, and then I stop it with my shoulder. All right. And I hear this really loud crack, and I think, man, we broke the fridge. And then I move my arm a little bit, and I heard the grind of collarbone on the other part of the collarbone, and I realized, no, we didn't break the fridge. We broke me. And I had some surge of adrenaline where I just grabbed the fridge with my left hand and lowered it the rest of the way. And then there was only one way into this basement, and it was currently blocked by a fridge. And so I was just trapped down there. I had fallen down, and I was alone. And thank God for cell phones. The first thing I did was I called my wife, and I told her what happened. And then I called my brother, which I should have done a half hour earlier. And he came over and was able to get the fridge out of the way, and he's like, man, why didn't you call me? And I was like, I don't know. I should have done that. But it's the kind of thing where it's like, I'm glad I had other people in my life when I had fallen down, because there were people in my life that were able to move in at a point where I was weak. Not just getting me out of the basement, but getting me to the hospital and take care of all the other duties that I had dumped on other people through my own foolishness. And yet that's the value of relationships. You don't start building them once the crisis hits. You've got the relationships before the crisis, before the fall. And then you're there to help each other. Two people lying close together can keep each other warm. This is not just talking about marriage here, okay? You know, two travelers on the road back then, it gets chilly at night in Palestine. You'd lie down right next to each other. In fact, I had some friends a couple years ago. They went out to, a big group of them went out to Colorado to camp in the middle of August up in the mountains, and it was a lot colder than they expected. And so, you know, one night it was freeze to death or two dudes climbing into the same sleeping bag. And so they went for it. And they kept warm. But we can bring comfort to each other. We can supply something the other person that on our own we wouldn't, neither of us would have it. Together we can both have it. How can one be warm alone? Loneliness is cold. Okay? It just feels cold, loneliness, especially this time of year. And finally, a person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. And so we're in the fight together. We've got each other's back. You know, the friends I'm closest to are the friends that I've been through things together, that I've been through crises, I've been through battles together. And that means we've got something worth fighting about that we're both on the same page about. This is not a friendship just based on we are into each other, but this is, we've got a common interest. And he ends with three are even better than two, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. And so you get a third in there, and you know, I guess this would apply to marriage, right? I mean, a marriage shouldn't just be an island, but should be connected to others. It would apply to, you know, groups of friends. This would also apply to spiritual relationships, where it's, we have a friendship, but God is also part of our friendship. Anyone can be that third cord in this rope. Yeah, friendship is costly, but you know what's more costly? Loneliness. Loneliness is a lot more costly. And sometimes our obsession with work is what robs us of our relationships. Look at the cost of loneliness. They've done studies on how much do certain things decrease your lifespan. Air pollution can decrease it by 5%, obesity by 20%, excessive alcohol by 30%. But you know what they've studied loneliness and how much that decreases your lifespan, your mortality? 45%. This is a review of 148 different studies. This is a meta-analytic review. Nearly a third of a million people across these 148 studies. Loneliness is harmful. John Cacioppo from Chicago, he's done a lot of research in this area. He says, our study showed that loneliness on a given day predicted a higher rise in cortisol, that stress hormone, the next morning. It can even have an effect from day to day, loneliness. We found loneliness also somehow penetrated to the deepest recesses of the cell to alter the way genes were being expressed. Loneliness predicted changes in DNA transcription in the billions of cells in your body. And that in turn made changes to the cell sensitivity to circulating cortisol, dampening the ability to shut off the inflammatory response. Loneliness goes all the way down to the molecular, the cellular level. An article about 6 months into the pandemic said this, the mental health consequences of COVID-19 are already visible, and even by conservative estimates, they're yet to reach their peak and likely to considerably outlive the current pandemic. This loneliness leaves a blast zone in our lives. It builds up in our system, and then it can take time to come out on the other end of it. That's why some of us, the pandemic is certainly closer to done than it was before, and yet we still are feeling the effects of it. Finally, Putnam, researcher in this area, his book Bowling Alone, writes, the single most common finding from half a century's research that on the correlates of life satisfaction, you know the top thing that correlated with life satisfaction, not only in the U.S. but around the world? Happiness is best predicted by the breadth and depth of one's social connections. That's what Solomon discovered 3,000 years ago. That's what God has been teaching since the beginning based on our design. And this is what we need in our lives. The cord. Yeah, two are better than one and three are even better, Solomon says, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. We might need to curb our freedoms in order to build some relationships. There might be things that we won't be able to do. You know, a person can't both be in a relationship and be completely autonomous to do whatever they want whenever they want without telling the other person. You're either free to be in the relationship or free to do whatever you want whenever you want. And it's like that with relationships. We might have to curb some of our freedoms. We might have to, you know, curb some of our time constraints to devote time to this. This is not easy. It's not going to happen overnight. This seems especially difficult for men. I don't know why that is. Women seem to naturally see this a little more clearly. Not always. But society has this picture of a man that's like tough and autonomous and can just take it and is an island. And that's not manly. That's weak and foolish. And you'll end up unproductive, cold, falling down. It'll bring you to ruin, Solomon says. And so guys, we're going to have to especially be aware that something seems to be stacked against us in this area. We're going to have to invest. And we're going to need time, and we're going to need the power of God in order to succeed at this. That's really where this is all headed. Is this is not something we can accomplish on our own, but we need the God who is love to one, bring us into a relationship with him, and then two, teach us how to love other people as he loves us. So application, we need to find that balance. One handful of quietness, one handful of work. Some of us maybe we're on the no handful side. We're like the fool, we're lazy. So we need to consider, is that because I've been taking a wrong view of work? Do I just need to reevaluate my view of work? Ask God to change me in this area. There's a lot more that could be said about that. Others, though, are frantically scrambling to compete, frantically scrambling to matter. And if you're in that category, it starts with your identity. You must find an identity apart from your work, your schooling, your accomplishments. You can't define yourself by your achievements and by how you compare to others, because that is all going to dry up someday. This question, why do I matter? You've got to be able to answer that. And the good news is God offers significance apart from your works. Jesus died for you. Salvation is not by works. You can't work for it. He did the work. He offers it as a gift. And that is the gateway into everything else, all the good things God has for you in the area of work. Practically, in this area, you may need to take control of your schedule. We like to complain about our schedules. Here's the thing. You're the one that scheduled it. You are in control of your life. And you need to think about that. How am I setting up my life? You know, build rest into your schedule. Build the right priorities into your schedule. Do you have that? And is your rest really restful? Or are you more exhausted than when you started? maybe just simplify your life as well. There may be some cuts that need to happen in our life. We can't do it all. We got endless options. We can't do it all. We might need to cut some good things for the better things. And we need to arrange our life according to God's template here, according to wisdom. You need to devote some time to real relationships. Instead of devoting so much time to the achievement, devote some time to achieving in this area, to something that really matters, that's really going to make you happy. Some of us like the idea of relationships, but don't want to devote the time. You know, it's like I've talked to people. They show up at like a meeting like this, and they're like, this is so great. I needed this so much. I missed you guys. I've just been so busy. And it's like they like the idea of it, but they're never going to get it if they don't devote the time. You're going to have to just rearrange some things. Make time for relationships. It doesn't have to be here, but find a place where you can do that, where you can build spiritual relationships. It might require some character growth. There might be things about me that are making it hard for other people to be around me. God wants to change you in those areas. It's going to require a common goal as well. C.S. Lewis talks about friendship in his book, The Four Loves. He talks about four different types of love, and one of the types is friendship. And he said, friendship, friends stand side by side with their eyes looking ahead. And that's why those pathetic people who simply want friends can never make any. When we come together around a common cause, like the things of God, then all of a sudden our friendship has a focal point, has something to rally around. And we're not just making friends for the sake of making friends, but it's around a common purpose. And that's one of the great things God contributes to our relationships, among others. Finally, you want to build relationships, begin a relationship with God. You know, 1 John 4 says, we love because God first loved us. He's the great God who is love, and he teaches us how to love. He demonstrated that by giving his son for us, by sending Jesus to die on the cross for us. And then, once you're in a relationship with him, he'll have some fulfilling work for you to do. Like Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me in to accomplish his work. That's the satisfying food that we'll be able to consume once we come into a relationship with him. Yeah, God, instead of having to compete with one another and biting and devouring one another, you offer us a different way. You offer us the way of grace. You offer us your love. And you teach us, you set us free. You give us meaning, Lord, so that we don't have to construct some meaning on the backs of other people, but we can just take our meaning from you, and that leaves us free to love other people. So I'm thankful for that, and I pray that that would set us free to actually enjoy work the way it was intended to be, not as something to be avoided at all costs or something to define who I am, but something to make a meaningful contribution and to live in line with our design. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.